The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly today, FA Cup semi-final picture becomes clear, as does Arsenal's diary for April and May. Another Manchester derby on the way, Wolf and Bolton Stoke, with one of them certain to take a place in Europe. We might just see Leo Messi trying to do it on a wet night in Stoke. Meantime, more Champions League second legs, and look out, Barry, here come the French. Can Lyon put out Real Madrid? Can Marseille show Man United the door? We take a look at the Olympic Games. Italy, there's a head-stomping laser-guided Rome derby, the stupidest red card in a long while, plus Italy a fret over a Bayern fixture threat. Nothing to do with Luciano Moggi this time, but into second leg in Munich. All that plus posts, tweets and much, much more in Football Weekly. Hello, everybody. A new week begins. And with it, wild-eyed with excitement, Barney Roney joins the pod team. Hi, Barney.
Hi, James.
Alongside him, Kevin McCarra.
Hello, James.
Hi, Kevin. And Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
Excellent. Now, Kevin, the delights of Old Trafford were yours on Saturday.
Yes, indeed. And the familiar outcome occurred with Arsenal kind of messing about, not doing very much and being beaten. They do live up to the stereotype, don't they?
Arsenal. We've talked a lot about Arsenal, though. I'm just wondering if we should keep the Arsenal stuff on
it. Yes, well, let's talk about Manchester United.
Yeah, and let's start with their curious team selection.
Yeah, it's curious. At the time, it was startling. But, of course, as the game unfolds, you think, ah, this man Ferguson may have a plan here. And you think he played what we think of as two fullbacks in the Da Silva twins in midfield. Field. But that really blocked the flanks, and Arsenal had no other options to explore. They had Van Persie through the middle, and that's about it, with Diaby trying to play behind him as an attacking midfield player and not doing very well. So Arsenal were extremely well contained by that.
The De Silva twins, they look fantastic, don't they? On that lovely breaking move for the first United goal. It makes sense playing twins, doesn't it, with their understanding of that?
Yes, planned by the genetics lab at Manchester United about 20-odd years ago. Yeah, the energy is important to United because a lot of the players do seem very familiar to us and maybe a bit stale. And if they can bring in younger players like the Silvas and, Hernandez is relatively new, it does brighten up the squad. There hasn't been great spending at Old Trafford. I mean, I dare say the Glazers wouldn't approve of it. But I think Ferguson has managed to refresh the team to an extent.
Is this often how Man United pick teams against Arsenal, isn't it? I mean, you often see them with quite an abrasive defender-packed midfield, and it does seem to work against them.
Yeah, but I would say that the Silvers weren't particularly defensive. I mean, certainly they can cover, and they did bottle up Arsenal, but it wasn't negative. I mean, they really imposed some pressure.
John O'Shea always gets a game in the middle, doesn't he, in these games. You just wonder against other teams whether, you know, I mean, you say it's good to see these younger, but I mean, playing, it's not really...
No, I mean, the Gibson-O'Shea partnership wasn't enchanting in the centre of the midfield. but they were there to do that so that the Silvers could push forward with more freedom in the wings. Yeah. As ever, the balance was good.
I think Ferguson's got one of the most versatile kind of squads in the Premier League, though. I know that, you know, people have picked holes in the squad as well, but there's a lot of players who can play in different positions across the midfield and in defence as well. And he's probably one of the best managers, I think, for... being able to use players out of position and get something out of them. I remember, I think some seasons ago, we used Giggs and O'Shea as a centre midfield partnership, and I'm not sure whether they won the league or finished second that season, but just for that midfield to do so well is quite a positive thing for Ferguson to be able to do.
I mean, there was a time long ago when people thought, Ferguson doesn't have it for Europe, which is an absurd argument, given he won the Cup Winners' Cup with Aberdeen and so on all those years ago. But I think people do see now how astute he is, and this is a kind of a European game playing Arsenal, and I think he outthought Wenger comprehensively.
Well, we raised the spectre on Thursday of United's Champions League win over Arsenal a couple of years back and the effect that seemed to have on the Gunners' campaign. Of course, we'll see next weekend when the Premier League returns with Arsenal now fighting on one front, whether that will in any way be an advantage.
Are you predicting their season might start falling apart now?
It seems unlikely, I know, Barney, but you have to factor in that Juru's now out for the rest of the campaign.
Yeah, it's a real blow. He's been really good for them at the back.
Ada Nod, 22, says, please mention that Wenger never said we are going to win a quadruple because I'm so bored of hearing it. Did he say it?
No. I've never heard him say that.
Did he mention the quadruple?
There was a story about Wenger mentioning the quadruple. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But I remember a few weeks ago that he did. There was some talk about...
He's obviously noted that they're still in four.
Yeah, I mean, he probably said
interpreted as, we're going for the quadruple.
Well, he probably said we can win each of these competitions, which is true. You know, will they win is another thing.
He's in a corner. You can't say anything else, can you? I think I'll lose a couple of them.
Can I say, I think Arsenal have actually done pretty well this season, even though it's all unravelled really quickly. They are still second in the league. They have a very young team. They've lost to Barcelona, who are the best team ever.
Barcelona and Man United in the two cup competitions.
And
Birmingham, of course. That's never an easy one.
Yeah, but they got Barcelona because they came second in an easy group.
That's a very good point.
They brought it upon themselves.
Mm. Although I did think watching the match at the weekend that it just reminded me of that scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, the first 20 minutes where Arsenal were just playing, you know, possession football, completely dominating, and United just sat back. And do you remember, is it the guy with the swords? The guy with the swords,
wielding the swords
and Indiana Jones is just looking at him, and he watches him for a while and then he just gets his gun out and shoots him.
Can I just say, that's probably the most iconic scene in the last 20 years of cinema. How can I possibly have got it wrong?
I don't know. Maybe your brain's melted since you watched that fourth abomination or whatever. You know,
it wasn't an abomination, as I've made clear previously.
It was improvised, wasn't it, that scene?
What, the one So they say. Mm. Harrison Ford's big one for the improvisations because, of course, the iconic moment from the Star Wars films that's very dear to your heart, Barney, when he's about to be cryogenically frozen, you know, in the carbon block, and Leia says to him, for the first time, says, "I love you." The script was down for him to say, "So do I," or "You look nice in that dress," or something like that. And Harrison just went, "I know."
Can I just say, could you look into my eyes again and say, "I love you"? It was a great, great moment.
Moments of pop magic, listeners. How about that upcoming Manchester derby? That's a sizzling thought then, isn't it? Because Man City had a rip-roaring 1-0 win over Reading. I think most of us actually saw this game for our sins.
Yes, I did. I watched it.
Yeah.
But isn't it funny how for that amount of money you can be immensely tedious? I mean, Man City...
When you looked at me and said that, I thought...
We'll leave that till later. Yeah. Man City, but I know they're tired, blah, blah, blah. But even when they're not tired... They just seem to want to win by the minimum score, you know. I don't understand. If you're the owner and you spent hundreds of millions, wouldn't you want a spectacle, you know, or some kind of feeling that football's exciting?
Why are they tired anyway?
Thrilling?
They've got about 147 players, which they can switch and play two different teams each match.
Actually, I do think most teams are tired, I mean, not just them, but some still entertain to a degree. I thought that game was torture yesterday.
Mm. Yeah. What about this business of Micah Richardson is bust up with Mancini? Was there any truth to that? Apparently they had a set to in the dressing room, as often seems to be the case at Man City.
Well, how
after
do these
the
stories come out
Kiev?
As well? I mean, it seems to be a particularly leaky dressing room, doesn't it? Because I imagine there's quite a few set tos in quite a few dressing rooms, and he's a feisty young chap. And
Mancini's as well.
Yeah.
I was also puzzled by Mancini. That's things like buying Dzeko without any obvious idea of how he's going to fit him into the scheme. You know, I've seen some games Dzeko playing left, some games Tevez way behind and Dzeko further forward. But it seems like to have bought him first and then tried to figure out later what to do.
Do you think that's his signing, though, Dzeko? Or do you think it's the board signing the players?
I suspect the problem is I can't really imagine the board had a fixation with Dzeko. That seems more like a managerial
It's only because
choice.
He costs so much money that maybe he bought him as a backup striker, and because it's Man City, you end up paying 30 million, and it starts looking a little odd that he's not starting every game.
Mm. So, as you say, a disappointing performance against a Reading team that cost a mere fraction of the budget lavished on that City side. Perhaps more interesting for United, who are very much fighting on three fronts, is the Champions League second leg of their last 16 clash with Olympique Marseille. Let's see if we can dial up Paul Doyle now, who's all over that thing. Paul, how are you?
I'm fine, James. How are you?
Yes, very well. And so is everybody here with me as we look forward to a big clash at Old Trafford, Man United against Olympique Marseille, 0-0 in the first leg. What are the Marseillaises' chance of marching on and all that and showing United the door?
I would say United are favourites, but it's certainly not out of the question that Marseille will progress. I think they got the result that they were looking for in the first leg, which, as you say, was 0-0 at home, which means, of course, that they may only need one goal to get through to the next round, and I think they quite fancy their chances of getting one goal and restricting United to less than two, which will put them through.
Right. They have a terrific record, of course, at home, United, as everyone knows. They've also only conceded once in Europe this season. What about the Marseille team makes you think that they can put one in the net?
First of all, Marseille, very much like United, actually. have been criticised for most of the season for not playing that well, yet somehow getting results. But now, as we approach the business end of the season, like true champions and teams with genuine mental strength, their performances are improving. And they have been better away for most of the season, unlike United, who, of course, who have been rubbish away generally. It will suit them. They'll be happy enough to try and absorb United's pressure and strike very quickly on the counter-attack through the likes of Andre Ayew, who, for example, is one of their players who's in terrific form at the moment, contrary to a lot of expectations. I think at the start of the season, he's only 21. He wasn't supposed to be one of their stalwarts going into the season, but he has been one of the few players who has been regularly excellent throughout the season, and he will provide a real test for United's right back, whoever that might be.
All right. They're, what, 4 points off the top of Ligue 1 after a victory last Friday?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at the table. Oh, okay. But they did have a very good victory last Friday. They went to Rennes, who had the best defence in Ligue 1 this season, and so in that sense it was a good preparation for going to United. And they won 2-0, they penetrated the best defence in Ligue 1 twice and generally controlled the match for most of the game.
All right. Marseille are looking to get into the last eight of this competition for the first time since they actually won the Champions League back in 92-93. Is there a lot of excitement in France about this?
There's mounting excitement about it. When the draw was made, I think everyone expected Marseille to be dumped out. Didn't fancy their chance of beating them. But as I said, they have improved slightly over the last few weeks. As an aside, I think that victory in 1993 should really be deleted from the books, given what Bernard Tapie was up to that season. Didier Deschamps is, as you would expect, a big factor in it. And he has a great knack for rejigging or making big decisions and getting them right at exactly the right time. And so, for example, just last Friday, with an eye on the United match, he made a little bit of a tactical adjustment to his team, and it worked. So, and that mainly revolved around Gabriel Heinze, who was fairly tormented by Nani in the first leg at left back. But he has been shifted now and more than likely will play in the centre of defence on Tuesday. That serves two functions. Firstly, it means that the left back will now be Ty Taiwo, who is faster than Heinze, so has a better chance of keeping up with Nani if Nani returns, or whoever else it will be there. And also, in terms of nicking an away goal, he has a terrific shot on him. So it wouldn't surprise me if, for example, if they did get a goal from a set piece, courtesy of him. And also, the fact that Heinze went into the centre of defence meant that Stefan Mbia, who played in the centre of defence in the first leg, has been moved into midfield, which is where he played most of his career until Deschamps last season moved him back into the centre of defence, very much against the player's wishes, but he performed really well there and was one of the main reasons that they won the title. But he's now back in midfield, it looks like, for the game at Old Trafford, and he has much more dynamism than Edouard Cissé, who will most likely be dropped. He's coming towards the end of his career now. So that one change of Heinze could be significant.
All sounds very positive. Nani actually trained today. Kevin's got a point. I was also going to quickly ask you about the Lyon-Real Madrid game. But Kevin, over to you.
It's a very small point. Just talking about United having to score goals and so on. People underestimate what United have done this season. They've got 39 goals at home in the Premier League, far more than anyone else. And this despite the fact that Wayne Rooney is only just recovering form and, you know, Berbatov is often on the bench. There's more depth to the United attack than people seem to realise. Especially if Hernandez already in double figures this season, despite the fact he doesn't always start.
Yeah,
I think he should start tomorrow.
He may well do, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, especially with Heinze in the middle, because Hernandez is probably quicker than Rooney as much as anything.
What about Lyon and their chances against Real Madrid? They have a terrific record. They've got an unbeaten sequence against Madrid, 7 games long now. And, of course, it was 1-1 in the first leg there at the Stade Juland.
Yeah, that's true. They were quite lucky to get a 1-1 in that match. I think Madrid sort of just dozed off in the last few minutes to allow them back into it, but dominated most of it until then. The good news for Lyon ahead of that is Lisandro, who missed the first leg, will be back. And he's been in great form recently. He will probably play on the left side of the attack rather than through the middle, where he scored a hat-trick last week. But he'll probably play on the left side because Michel Bastos, unfortunately, is missing. He was probably Lyon's best player in the first leg. But But with Lisandro and Bafé Gomis up front, they formed a great understanding. And again, there is a chance that they could score, but I can't see them scoring more than Real, especially with Karim Benzema seemingly being in vastly improved form recently.
Yeah, indeed so. Paul, that's excellent stuff. Many thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
All right, nice one.
Bye.
Thank you, Paul Doyle. On the subject of Man United, they're involved in all sorts of competitions at the moment. Greg, you got news there? What is it, the youth?
Yeah, the FA Youth Cup quarter-final yesterday at Anfield. It kind of made the match between Liverpool and United in the Premier League look a bit...
tame?
Yeah, in comparison. Apparently, well, Liverpool took a lead, went 2-0 ahead against United, and they both got very good youth teams, but Man United came back. I think, Barney, who did you say? Did somebody play particularly well for?
Ravel Morrison scored the winner.
Yeah, he scored the winner.
The very promising Man United teen.
Yeah, well, and during all this, apparently there were 6 Man United fans were thrown out of Anfield for drunkenness and being disorderly. And also there was apparently some quite horrific chanting about Hillsborough and Heysel as well. But the most dramatic thing was there was a striker, Man United striker, Paul Pogba, apparently. He received a second yellow card for an exaggerated run-up. Apparently the referee thought the run-up was over the top and he got a second yellow card and was sent off.
Was it Python-esque or did he start from his own goal?
Exaggerated in what way? Like,
well, this is... I mean, I've got no more detail about it. Unfortunately, I wasn't there. I was in work yesterday.
Was it mocking and sarcastic?
Well, yeah, well, I mean, how exaggerated can a run-up be? I mean,
maybe it was just too long.
Is it John Cleese-esque or is it, like you say, is it from the halfway line? Did he waste time whilst he was running up? I don't know if any listeners went who could maybe comment underneath Football Weekly today.
Yeah. Well, that's all very exciting. The part two awaits in a second or two in which we look at Stoke and Bolton, of course, the other big winners in the FA Cup this weekend. And we hear from Sim Lowe in Madrid. Game of the weekend, Barney Roney, Birmingham Bolton.
Yeah, it was a great game. I mean, I enjoyed the fact that all 5 goals in this game came from, in some way, from a flick-on. That seems like an important moment in English football history. Mm. It was a cracking game. And Bolton are a really good team to watch. I always enjoy watching them. They're a nice kind of mixture of bruising and also skillful at the same time. And Kevin Davis was irresistible against the kind of team who... would have probably fancied their chances defending against him. Although he was up against Curtis Davies, who probably is one of the least impressive £8 million defenders in the world.
What about that Kevin Phillips goal?
Yeah, it was a brilliant goal, wasn't it? From a flick-on.
He just
a brilliant kind of a poacher's strike. Well, more than a poacher's strike. It was quite spectacular.
It was spectacular.
Yeah.
Spectacular.
He's still got it.
He has
37
got
years
it.
Old.
Yeah. Like, he's saying if he's an OEP, he'd still want him and his team is just, you know, it's got something about him.
Well, yeah, I'm having been to watch the oldest man in Britain still play football this weekend,
oh, yes.
I'm all for the silver foxes in the box.
All right, tell us more. I know that Stoke fans will be dying to hear about their triumph over West Ham, but first, the oldest man in football, or the oldest man in Britain still playing football.
Yeah, well, I went to watch what we thought was the worst team in the country. They've conceded 170 goals in 17 games this season. They keep losing. They've been losing 19-0. And this is a proper level. It's not park football.
Proper level like what?
Well, it's the Staffordshire Counties League.
Right.
It's not a particularly high level, but it's not.
Give me a number. What tier of the game is that?
10th tier, the 10th tier of the pyramid. And I discovered that this is basically a team for players who don't want to retire. They've got a 75-year-old who plays them, a 70-year-old, a 60-year-old in central defence,
right.
Another 70-year-old. They're just really great old guys, really trim and fit and just doing it because they love playing. Obviously, also not that good, but they were quite inspiring.
What was the score when you went?
It finished 10-0, but it was 8-0 at half-time, so the second half was sort of something to build on. They defended deep in the second half.
Did they attack at all?
The attack was a little bit toothless.
Yeah. Is the goal too far away, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they got a couple of 18-year-olds playing for them as well, so there's a 58-year age gap in the team, 57-year. It was quite a sort of remarkable experience, but they're great. I mean, just brilliant, really.
That's fantastic, isn't it? Also fantastic was your experiences at Stoke Railway Station. Getting on the train was pretty good, I should think. But yeah,
it was just funny because I bumped into Jermaine Pennant, who was putting someone onto a train to London. He was putting he was almost like an advert for Jermaine Pennant. It was like an infomercial for Jermaine Pennant,
right.
Persuading you that he was a really nice guy because he was pushing a pram.
Yes.
And I was looking and thinking, he really looks like Jermaine Pennant, but it can't be Jermaine Pennant because he's just in the train station pushing a pram. But he put this... a young lady onto the train. He lifted the pram up, and he seemed like a really nice bloke. And no doubt he then walked out of the train station and forgot he'd parked his Bentley in the car park. No, let's not spoil
it. In a disabled spot, I think.
Yeah. And he also played very well yesterday.
Yeah, and I watched his performance even more keenly, having seen him being such a gentleman at the train station. And
was he getting the Virgin Pendolino himself?
No, he was putting someone on it.
They're ironically named virgins. No, there's no need for that kind of thing. And, you mentioned Jermaine in action then in the Stoke West Ham game. Terrifically exciting finale, which I managed to catch. What was the rest of it like?
It was fairly kind of raw stuff.
Was it?
Yeah.
Mike Jones had a bit of a mare, did he not, as referee?
He couldn't see it was no position to tell whether the guy had armed the ball or not.
Right.
And the linesman, I think, couldn't see it either, so it was...
This is the picky on equaliser.
Yeah, it seems to be more like his upper arm rather than chest.
There's about three or four different replays of that, and I don't think it was possible to even tell off those. So, I mean, I've got no idea how a referee is supposed to be able to tell us.
I mean, looking at the position open, I don't know how they could have seen that. It's impossible. Mm. The view's obstructed of his body there, you know.
So say Stoke's first goal was like Uber Stoke. It was they kind of stoked the first goal in. It was Rory Delap with a huge throw in again, and Tony Pulis must have been really, really happy about it, because I forget who the Stoke player was in the box, but blocked off the West Ham defender perfectly, and Robert Huth just had a 10-yard run straight onto the ball.
It's underrated, the blocking off, isn't it?
It's a good tactic if you can get it right, and you can also con the referee somewhat.
Do you think Stoke sat around after that saying, God, that was really like Stoke, wasn't it?
I've
got a theory that teams like when Stoke are playing, and also at the other end of the spectrum, you know, the polarity with Barcelona, when teams like that are playing, it referees tend to make more mistakes because they just put more pressure on the referee. The game is either extremely physical in Stoke's case or not particularly physical in Barcelona's case, but tempting the opposition into reacting in a physical way. And you put constant pressure on the referee. He is constantly monitoring every single move because it's pushing the boundaries of the rules, and he's going to make a mistake at some point.
Tony Pulis actually, speaking in one of the papers today, defending his record, saying people will never give us a chance here. Since I've been here in 2.5 years, we've had 3 quarterfinals, 2 FA Cups and one in the League Cup, and finished 12th and 11th. So it's very effective football, isn't it?
I think what Stoke do is brilliant. I mean, they've got a tactical system where everybody knows what they're doing. It's incredibly well organised, and it works.
And they use home advantage, probably, you know, they lean more heavily on home advantage than any other club because of the fact that they've got the boardings brought further back and the towels there lined up as well, you know.
They won't have that advantage, of course, at Wembley in the semi-final against Bolton. They will have ample opportunity to preview that game when it rolls around in mid-April. We were mentioning back at the start the fact that Bolton and Stoke will be playing each other means that one of those teams, whoever wins, Greg, will be guaranteed a place in the Europa League.
Yeah. As far as I understand it, they will get the place because Man City or Man United, who will meet in the final, are already into the Champions League. And the place...
Don't balls up their top
four. Yeah. Assuming that, then the place will go to either Stoke or Bolton rather than the sixth place team in the Premier League, which
so
happens to be
four,
Liverpool.
The top four are going to the Champions... Oh, right, OK. Top four Champions League, and then the fifth place team will go into the Europa League. And then you'll have Birmingham from the League Cup, and then one of these two.
Yeah.
What happens if Spurs overtake Man City because they're only 1 point behind?
A game in hand.
2 points in hand if they win their game in hand.
They're 5 points behind for a game in hand, Spurs, so it's not quite settled yet, Benny.
Well, as long as Man City are in the top four, am I right?
Yeah, but they could be removed.
They could be removed from that if Spurs overtake them, which they could well do. They're 2 points down back if they win
a bit of tension there.
Yeah, that's made it quite tense. Because, I mean, even Spurs could get to the semi-final of the Champions League and then not be in Europe next season, you know. So, or
they could win the Champions League and then they would get the, I think, the fifth place.
Yeah, as champions, Liverpool created that, didn't they?
They did. Yeah, and then what would happen? Who knows? Anyway, let's dial up Sid Lowe to find out about some interesting developments in the Liga and also get his look forward to the midweek games. Sid Lowe.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. Dare I ask how you are?
If you don't want the gory details, probably best not to. I'm feeling too great, to be honest.
All right. How graphic are the gory details? Which end, Sid?
Both.
Really? Is it some sort of gastric thing?
I can only assume so, yeah.
Oh dear, I'm awfully sorry to hear about that. Did that in any way curtail your viewing activities this weekend?
No, because it hit me late last night.
Oh, all right then. Well,
after I'd watched Barcelona Sevilla, which was fantastically good.
All right, okay. And you had some, I was going to make jokes about runs of your own, but I don't think anybody wants that kind of thing. It was a disappointing performance, was it? Sport, the Catalan paper says, it's a good point, 1-1 for Barcelona at Sevilla. But Marca, I noticed in Madrid, say, the league is on.
Well, they're both right. I think they're both right in the sense that the league is on because this makes it only 5 points Barcelona's lead at the top of the table. Although it's effectively 6 because at the end of the season, head-to-head goal difference will separate the two sides. And unless Madrid can beat Barcelona 5-0, then of course that won't be balanced back out into Madrid's favour. So Barcelona sort of have a 6-point lead now. It's actually 5. I think away a point in Seville really isn't bad at all. And if you look at the way the fixtures fall, and you ask yourself, all right, which of the games where Madrid and Barcelona realistically will drop points between now and the end of the season? And you have to look at the away games and you would say, well, away in Valencia, away in Seville, away in Bilbao, away at Villarreal. Well, Barcelona have been to Bilbao and won, they've been to Valencia and won, and they've now been to Seville and drawn. Real Madrid, they've still got Villarreal to come, I think, in 2 weeks' time. Real Madrid have got to go to all of those teams still. Mm. And then, of course, as one Barcelona supporting comic genius put it yesterday, but the big deal really is that Barcelona don't have to play Barcelona yet, Real Madrid still do.
Sid Cash, something. Am I wrong in thinking that Barcelona seem to be getting a bit tired? It's understandable given the past few seasons they've had and players at World Cups and so on. Arsenal have been outrageous, yet they could have knocked them out for a late goal there in midweek. Are they faltering at all?
I think there's a couple of things to factor into the answer. One is that Barcelona train in such a way that to try and achieve basically two peaks in the season, from November until Christmas, and the other peak is from the back end of March for the rest of the season. So in that sense, it would be perfectly logical for Barcelona to have a little bit of a physical dip now. You look at their results, and it does look a little bit like it. They went away to Sporting and only got a 1-1 draw. They only beat Valencia 1-0. They were only able to win at home, I think I'm right saying 2-1, although I can't remember the game off the top of my head now. And now they've just drawn 1-1 with Sevilla away. So that would sort of suggest, well, the goals certainly are drying up a little bit. But I think that's a little bit of a red herring, because I think you have to look at it in the context of playing Champions League games either side, in the context of one or two injuries, and as well in the context of who they were playing. As I say, away at Valencia winning 1-0 is a really quite good result. Barcelona had never won there before. Drawing 1-1 with Sevilla is a pretty good result. And Barcelona will feel like they should have got more. In fact, they almost certainly should have done. That is probably the more worrying thing from their point of view. You know, all the talk about, well, if Arsenal hadn't had a man sent off, or if Nicolas Bentner had been able to score that chance at the end, yeah. And if Barcelona had scored their many, many, many chances. I think that's the thing that would worry them, that they're getting results that aren't quite as good as their play, at least they believe, suggests. And Pep Guardiola said last night, we are sowing rather more than we're harvesting right now.
Sid, a couple of questions. One from the beloved aunt, who wants you to shed some light on the Fabiano to Sao Paulo transfer.
Quite bizarre.
Yeah.
Quite bizarre, because basically Luis Fabiano almost joined Sao Paulo this week without anyone noticing. I think I'm right in saying it was Thursday night. Everyone's talking about, right, the Sevilla side to face Barcelona at the weekend. Well, you know, Luis Fabiano, hang on, he's just gone. And it was just basically a photograph of him clearly taken either in a hotel room or in his bedroom at home on the mobile with him in a Sao Paulo shirt. And, oh, he's off. Sevilla say they've got €7 million for him. I must admit, I'd be surprised if Sao Paulo have really paid that much. But this is something that was coming for a long time. I mean, there's been bids for Luis Fabiano, and more importantly, there's been not bids for Luis Fabiano for a long time, with him talking about wanting to move away. Sevilla being very conscious of the fact that it would suit them to sell him, it would suit them to let him go. And I think in that sense, if they have got €7 million, then they will see this as business really, really well done. It's a real pity, because he scored a lot of goals, but he always gave the impression of being not entirely convinced that Sevilla was the right place for him, even though he ended up staying for 6 years.
Mm. Well, of course, his return to Brazil has been hailed by fans back home, because exciting player to be bringing into the championship there, or bringing back to the championship.
Yeah, and he's a great goal scorer. I'm sure he'll score a lot of goals still, because he's one of those players that sometimes you see him play and you think, well, not really sure that I can see what it is that makes him so great, but his finishing is very, very good. His control is good. Reads the game really well. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting signing for Luis.
Just give us a few words on Real Madrid's preparations for the clash with Lyon. Of course, Lyon have been very much their bête noire, excuse my French, in recent Champions League. What's the mood like in Madrid?
Well, they have been the Bête Noire, but there's the big advantage this time, which is that Real Madrid managed to score in France for the first time against Lyon. So they obviously go into this with a 1-1 from the first leg. Jose Mourinho was saying something in an interview the other day, which was quite interesting, although I suppose in a way it only confirms what we always assumed with Jose Mourinho when you see the way he approaches games. He said the most important thing in a two-legged European tie is to go into the second game knowing you don't necessarily have to win. That kind of pressure is taken off you, and that the other side is obliged to come out to some extent. It's been quite interesting this because there's a couple of things that I think sort of feed into it, which are quite interesting. One is the sudden and very, very, very good form indeed from Karim Benzema, who scored a brilliant goal in Lyon, who's scoring a lot of goals now in the Spanish league. He scored two in each of the last two games, and everybody's suddenly delighted with him, and that has helped, I think, to smooth the relationship as well to some extent between club and coach. Then you've got the fact that Lyon themselves seem to be trying to wind him up. Both Aulas, who's the president, and Puello, of course, is the coach of Lyon, have been pointing out that they expect certain things from Real Madrid, that Real Madrid will have to go and win this game. I think I'm right in saying that, which, try and get this right way around, Aulas, I think, said Mourinho has to win this game because he's arrogant and he wants to win, whereas Puello said, I think it's very, very obvious that Mourinho will try and draw this one 0-0. So there seems to be a bit of winding up going on. Personally, I don't think Real Madrid have too many problems. I think they'll get through relatively comfortably.
All right, although Ronaldo's, is he fit or not?
Yeah, he'll be fit. They said at the weekend that he might even have played had it not been for the fact that there was a Champions League game around the corner. So he'll be fit for this. Not entirely fit, not quite right, but they played pretty well without him. They won in Santander, and collectively, definitely their best performance of the season. They won on Saturday night, but it was one of those games that you see quite a lot of at the Bernabeu, where the other team's just not as good as Real Madrid, and Real Madrid don't need to be as good as Real Madrid can be, and they just sort of stroll to a win.
All right then, Sid. Well, listen, plenty of liquids and rest, and look forward to speaking to you on Thursday.
Yep, fantastic. Speak to you then.
Thanks, Sid. Couple of posts and tweets. Barney Rona, your views on AD Bothroyd. This is from Sky Blue Steve. AD Bothroyd sacked. Expect extensive coverage from Football Weekly.
Yeah, it was. I think people saw it coming. I've seen Coventry play once this season at QPR. It didn't look that great.
No. They've had one win in 16, I think, was it?
Yeah. Marlon King and 10 other blokes. Right. Bothroyd is a nice bloke, though, and he's very charming. He's a good talker. But he may be more of a presentational genius than a managerial genius.
DR1144 says, regarding the Ashley Vickers Mankini sending off for Dorchester, don't know if you saw this player sent off for tackling a Mankini-clad streaker's pitch invader who was basically making the field his own for minutes on end. He says, I used to work as a football steward. He says, first of all, Ashley Vickers is one of the most sent off players in football. I used to work as a football steward, says DR, etc. The head steward had one very clear instruction for us all. Any pitch invaders were to be left alone. His logic was that the crowd would soon tire of an attention seeker parading around and turn on him. Whereas the interloper would become the hero if he had become the quarry in a Harold Lloyd style chase scene involving stewards, police, etc.
When you dress up, generally people attack you. I used to have to dress up as Mr. Wimpy as one of my former jobs, and I used to get attacked quite often by kids.
Mr. Really? Wimpy,
and they would chase after me.
What did the costume involve?
It was a huge polished iron Mr. Wimpy head.
What was Mr. Wimpy? Was it a hamburger or what?
A hamburger man.
Yeah, and big red blow-up shoes. And, right. And you know, you'd think kids would take kindly to you, but they just don't like you.
What were
you
saying inside the suit? What were you saying, Mr. Wimpy?
I was swearing quite quietly in the suit. There was one time where I was quite badly behaved because this kid was charging me and I'd lifted my head down and just changed the angle slightly so he smacked into the polystyrene head. Right. He wouldn't charge me anymore. So.
Right.
Anyway, nothing to do with wearing a mankini, but I just thought it was worth mentioning.
Have you seen the best incident with a streaker I've ever seen in sport? It's a different sport. In cricket, the Andrew Simons shoulder barge on a streaker, a naked man runs on and he absolutely cleans him out with a shoulder barge, much in the roughly style.
Right, it's nice great. Excellent. If you were that kid charging that Mr. Wimpy, now you know who was inside. Were you outside a Wimpy restaurant?
No, I used to work at the Wimpy restaurant, and part when I wasn't flipping burgers, you'd have to dress up as Mr. Wimpy. Jeez. And go out and treat kids to the party burgers and be, you know, the fun guy, you know. So,
so you've got David Dunn on your hit list, random kid in a Wimpy costume. Yeah. Who's next?
Yeah, who indeed? Okay, Happy Goss, can we flag up the campaign of Grant Wall for FIFA presidential elections? He only needs one nomination in order to stand. He's the editor of Sports Illustrated. who is campaigning to, well, certainly I think raise questions about the FIFA presidency and the whole election thing by standing himself. Very happy to do that. Now, there's two other Champions League games coming up this midweek. Chelsea are up against Copenhagen, 2-0 up from the away leg, so that looks something of a formality. Less so, Bayern Munich's clash at the Allianz Arena with Inter, 1-0 to the German side after their first leg. Horrible Julio Cesar goalkeeping error there, right at the death, and Gomez with the goal, which might prove crucial. Big game, that. Inter only managed to draw with relegation-bound Brescia this weekend, whereas Bayern Munich, as you no doubt saw, 6-0. Mm. No sooner had they told that man Van Gaal that he might want to clear his desk, etc., for the end of the season, then hey presto. And the net result of that was that Hamburg, the team beaten 6-0, then fired their manager, whose name is, because I can't pronounce this right,
Vey.
Bayern Munich scoring loads of goals, Inter conceding lots of goals, even Brescia scoring against them.
Aren't Bayern's in collapse in terms of domestic football?
The thing is, they're only 3 points off the top three now with that victory over Hamburg.
I mean, given this, I mean, they're out of scale to everyone else in the Bundesliga, aren't they? I mean, enormous income because of their countrywide appeal and so on, and their commercial deals. I mean, it's a very poor effort so far.
It is, and hence Van Gaal's he's on his way, departure. Isn't it? But getting into the Champions League at least, I think, would you know, redeem in some way the season. And then who knows how far they'll go in the competition this year. I should mention, beyond their draw with Brescia, which was seen as almost being the end of their title campaign, but then Sunday night, Milan, who were facing bottom of the table, Bari, could only manage a 1-1 draw. Ibrahimovic continuing his disastrous run of form. Paolo Bandini advancing the theory in last week's pod that it's not so much that he's a big game bottler, just that he's always rubbish at this time of year when the big games happen to be. Because he's also being rubbish against bottom of the table Bari. Missed a couple of opportunities. He scored once, but handled in the build-up. And then got sent off for punching an opponent in the stomach, which wasn't very clever. So the gap remains 5 points at the top. You've got Milan top, 5 points clear of Inter. Then Napoli, who are only 1 point behind Inter. Then you've got Udinese, 3 points behind them, and 2 points clear of Lazio. So it could well be Napoli and Udinese going into the Champions League. The Italians would be extremely happy to see Udinese in Europe. Or some of them would be anyway. I mean, certainly the papers today were actually saying, what a shame we can't stick them in right now, just to say to the rest of Europe, look, there is an Italian team that does play good football, and they're playing fantastic football.
Wasn't that an amazing slaughter neighbourhood last week that Spurs took it for granted that he could not score? And I mean, the whole assumption was they won't score, and how right Harry was. I mean, because people sometimes email saying Ibrahimovic is, you know, I guess a bad name in England and it's not fair. But every time we see him, he's, you know, useless.
Well, isn't one of Udinese's problems that whenever they create a good team and all these players come through, that all the bigger sides buy all their best players and you have to start again, though?
That's often been the case. It's interesting, though, how long they've managed to hang on to one or two of these players, like Di Natale, who famously turned down Juventus last summer. Well, there's a lot of talk of the fact that he didn't really turn them down, that the deal just wasn't in place, and then it's all been kind of given a bit of spin. But also Alexis Sanchez, who had a good World Cup, and I thought at the time, well, that would be him out the door, but they've hung on to him for the season. He's been absolutely brilliant, scored another brilliant goal starting from his own, pretty much his own penalty area this weekend away to Cagliari. The owner today, Gino Pozzo, was saying that if we make the Champions League, they might just keep them around. That would be terrific to see this team going and playing, because they're freewheeling. They're a proper team. The Rome derby, just quickly to say that Roma won their fifth derby in a row. A classic? Not really, no. Two goals from Francesco Totti, and Vincenzo Montella, his former teammate, of course, is still unbeaten thus in the league with Roma, but a great way for Roma to bounce back from their Champions League horror last week. Pizarro, fantastic game from him. Two Lazio players sent off. Matusalem wasn't one of them, although he should have been after stamping on Francesco Totti's head.
But I don't know why that's funny. Just saw this, isn't it?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
A minor lapse.
Yeah. It just shouldn't happen to Totti. How dare he?
Well, it shouldn't really happen to anyone. But Totti, to be fair, was remarkably restrained. Mm. Yeah, he didn't go chasing after him. Who did go chasing after someone was Radu. Extraordinary. I showed you this, Greg. The stupidest red card of this week, or possibly any.
Yeah.
There's a couple of players over by the corner flag arguing with the linesman. One of them is Fabio Simplicio, the Roma midfielder. So Stefan Radu decides to run across from the goal mouth, 30 yards, arrives in front of the linesman and headbutts Fabio Simplicio, and no choice but sent off.
And he doesn't even headbutt him properly. Yeah. He kind of does one of those scraping his forehead down and rutting stag kind of look, I'm in your face kind of headbutts, rather than a just, you know, just headbutt him and get it done and walk off. And
if you're going to headbutt someone, you can understand you might do it, you know, oh, look, no one's looking. But don't you run over to where the linesman's standing and do it in front of him? Does seem
I've got a theory that sort of forehead rubbing thing, that's evolved out of the you can't raise your hands culture, hasn't it? Because they put their hands down and then they're so angry that the head comes forward and they start rubbing. Because you don't even see that in any other walk of life. People don't rub heads with each other.
If the pecs were bigger, they'd do it with the chests. But
yeah, chest bumping.
Yeah.
And there you have it. That, I think, brings us to the end of this Football Weekly, unless anybody has anything else they want to add.
I was just going to mention just a couple of results in the Championship.
Go ahead.
John Ashdown isn't here to do it. Yeah. Norwich play tonight, and if they beat Bristol City, they can go clear of Swansea in second place, and they go within 10 points of QPR, who are currently top. And if QPR were dot points, then it could be that Norwich take over as the Championship leaders. Yeah. Although I do still fancy QPR to get promoted, given that they're so far ahead at the moment of the chasing pack.
We haven't really discussed the docking point scenario, which once again involves that man, Neil Warnock. I think with the kind of feeling is that we'll wait to see how real that possibility turns out to be. That, in the meantime, oh, sorry, was there any other
one? I know, and the other thing is that Derby beat Swansea, which is great news for Nigel Clough because he's had loads of pressure on him and the fans have been turning against him.
And Swansea's playoff push continues to falter.
Yeah, it continues to falter, but they're still in that. There's a pack of teams who've all failed recently, so Forest haven't been doing well either. Yeah. Leicester won it the weekend, which means that they, you know, have got another chance of getting back into the top two places.
Did you see Peter Whittingham's goal for Cardiff?
I didn't, but you can tell me about it.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. Took it down on his knee, waited for it to drop, and hit it sort of flat right into the top corner from about 25 yards. Absolutely brilliant.
Oh, I should mention Lama's goal for Catania. This was astonishing. You'll like this, even though there wasn't a flick on it involved. Basically, Catania, relegation threatened Catania. The ball, I think it was from a corner, comes screaming in. He's right on the edge of the box and he volleys it in. It's that simple, but it's great. Mm-hmm. Lovely to watch. And plus, his name is Lama. Anyway, that is it for today's Football Weekly. So do join us again on Thursday when we will return to discuss all the midweek many events and that kind of thing. In the meantime, many thanks to Barney Roney, Kevin McCarra and Greg Ruffley and producer Ian and you, the listener. We'll speak to you soon.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.